So we'll put those issues up there. Now let me start with a kind of a little bit of my personal narrative, my journey, my personal professional narrative, my journey into queerness, and my practice. So I'm a Haligonian. I'm an African Nova Scotian. My people come from Beachville, Lake Loon, Cherrybrook, the Prestons. Going back further, I have people who come from Amherst. So I'm a distant cousin of Dwayne the Rock Johnson. So there you have it. Distant cousin. I don't think he'd take my calls.
Well, you could try, Rob.
Yeah, there you go. Maybe. In a moment of desperation. So I've grown up in what I like to call the Black Baptist tradition, although as a very young child, I left my Baptist affiliations and affiliated with another church that was not affirming. Non-affirming church. As Baptists tend not to be affirming in this province. In fact, I think the only affirming Baptist church I'm aware of in the province of Nova Scotia is the First Baptist Church on Oxford Street, which actually had to leave the Baptist convention here in order to be able to do that.
Right. Harlow Johnston?
Is there now? What? Baptist Church. Okay.
Oh, we didn't know that.
Very good.
Because the one in Oxford, they just ordained their first LGBTQ minister.
Yeah.
The first folks in Canada.
Yeah. So I grew up a churchy, young, black guy in which, in my world, the idea of being queer was non-existent. And so I grew up probably from an early age knowing I could go either way here, but trained in social work, both at my undergraduate and graduate levels, did both my degrees in Christian universities, non-affirming universities, got probably one of the best clinical trainings possible. I'm a child, youth, and family forensic social worker. A clinical child, youth, and family forensic social worker. I did my clinical training at the Washington State Penitentiary because I did my graduate work in Walla Walla, Washington. Walla Walla, Washington. It's one of the place names you learn in clown school. It's like, you know, Tuscaloosa, Kalamazoo, Walla Walla, those sort of things. I should have said that during my undergraduate years, I married a woman. And I stayed in a marriage for 12 years, a marriage that had a shelf life of about 3. Right? My daughter was conceived at the end of that third year, and I buckled in for another 8 years. And so professionally, I should say, buckled in for another 8 years, separated, divorced, and and radically switched teams at that time. So I have not been with another cisgendered woman in the ensuing years, which would be, I don't know, 22, 23, something like that. Close to 25 years, I guess. So in terms of my professional work, I said I'm a clinical child, youth, family, forensic social worker. So I studied in a prison, did my clinical training in a school of social work. Social work kind of has this training around mental health that sees the whole person within the context of the environment, which is a little different than some other training. And I had notable roles in frontline child welfare here in Halifax. I was a child protection worker for several years. I was the race relations coordinator for the Dartmouth School Board in the early 90s. And I used to say that I was the department of isms and obias. So racism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, although there was no such thing as transphobia back then, right? 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 I think the practice was prevalent, but the naming was not. So those were the kinds of issues that I was steeped in, and of course, as a black guy, race being one of the main issues, I was very in tune with that. I also have taught at universities sessionally around the country, and certainly all over Nova Scotia. I think I've taught in, or guest lectured in all of the universities in Nova Scotia. Worked for a time as the executive director of child welfare in Cumberland County, where for 9 years I worked to really address some of the systemic oppression that occurs in child welfare to poor and marginalized peoples. It was there, really, that I got tuned into. I'd always been concerned about male sexual victimization, the sexual victimization of male and male-identified and masculine persons, because that seemed to be a real gap in our conception of sexual violence. And I found in my practice that boys and girls were being identified as victims of sexual violence almost in equal number, but that the service delivery for girls existed within the women's health community, and the service delivery for boys was kind of like, if we can stop the abuse and adjudicate the offenders, everything will be fine. And so there weren't really services for male-identified folks. So that was my time in child welfare. I worked for the IWK for a little bit in their child protection unit. And I also worked for government as the director of the Child and Youth Strategy. People here would remember the nun commission that followed that vehicular homicide, the young boy who stole the car and was being pursued by the police and ran through an intersection and killed Teresa McAvoy, the teacher's aide. And the province did a study about how is it possible that young people can be so out of control. And so they established a child and youth strategy to coordinate service delivery to children, youth, and families across the social ministries, health, education, community service, and justice. And I directed that work and shaped that work for its inaugural 4 years. And then I left government because I found they didn't know what to do with me and I had other ambitions. And so I started expanding my private practice and teaching a little bit more. And that's when I founded the People's Counseling Clinic out of my private practice, which is a nonprofit, community-based mental health clinic. We started, I guess, when we were on Hollis Street, and then we moved to Maitland Street, and then we're now on Bilby Street. I'm also the executive director of the African Nova Scotian Justice Institute. So justice, social justice, crime, criminality, violence, including sexual violence, and mental health. This is all kind of my sphere of work. I would say that when it comes to queer mental health, I would say that my interest in queer mental health comes from seeing the consequences of a lack of attention to creating safe spaces for queer folk to develop. So, for example, studies around homeless youth, and I'll get to, you know, talking about elders a little bit, but youth, that's kind of where I come from, that whole thing. But we know that when we think about homeless youth, surveys of homeless youth, the stats coming back from those surveys of young people who find themselves dislocated from housing, dislocated from home, are unbelievable stats. Because somewhere between 50 and 80% of young people who are homeless identify as part of the rainbow community.
50 to 80 identify as members.
Okay.
Of
that's I didn't. So we don't. The number is so ridiculous. We don't know what it means. Mm. We don't know what it means. Does it mean that homeless kids engage in sex that may not be their preferred sex in order to survive? Does it mean that being queer is one of the reasons why people find themselves dislocated from home and family and end up in these circumstances? I don't think we know. What we do know, that a dramatically disproportionate number of the homeless young people identify as queer. And I just want to pause there for a minute there, because I want your brain to do the cause and effect. Like, why is that? What's going on there? And when you have a statistic that says somewhere between 50 and 80, you know that there's some sponginess in the data, right?
Yeah.
There's sponginess in the data. But it's dramatic. It's not somewhere between 10 and 30. It's not somewhere between 20 and 50. It's somewhere between 50 and 80. Right?
And this is all, like, trans, bi, questioning all?
Yes. Yeah.
And is this across Canada?
Well, I've seen the studies here in Nova Scotia and across Canada and in other places. That's why the number is so spongy. Because in some jurisdictions the number is lower, in other jurisdictions the number is higher. I think that the number has to do in part with who's asking, right? Because if you're a marginally living young person who is seeking services, you're probably not going to identify yourself as part of the rainbow community if you think the person who is serving you isn't ready to hear that. So in those jurisdictions, I suspect the numbers would be lower. But if the study is being done by a group, for example, like folk from the Shag Lab, the number will be higher. Not because gay people are out there recruiting gays, right? But because people feel comfortable reporting their reality. And I don't want to be too dramatic, part of the reason I think that we have problems with queer mental health is because we still have problems dealing with human sexuality. Mm. Period.
Yeah.
Right? And I would say that if a person were in mental health were to identify themselves as a sex therapist, they would be considered somewhat skeptically by their mental health colleagues. Right? Right? Because, you know, it's kind of like, what's your interest in that? Like, what's the matter with you that you would focus on that issue? Right? Deep, you know, and so there is this reluctance, even within the mental health field, to deal with any elements of sex and sexuality. So I'm just going to put that out there. So we have that as kind of the baseline problem in mental health. And then if you divert at all from what I will call the hegemonic heteronormative sexuality, our ability and willingness and our training to engage decreases. Right? So, in a couple of weeks' time, just as an example, I was asked to work with the Child Welfare Agency to educate black foster parents about issues in relationship with caring for queer children.
Excellent.
Now, to begin that conversation, we actually have to consider the possibility that young children have a developing sexuality, and to say that out loud almost marks you as a pervert. Right? But we've all seen children who are identifying very, very early at 3 and 4 and 5 what part of the queer spectrum they're going to land on. Right? And yet, in the field, it is still very... saying that out loud creates a skepticism around your practice. But we all know, you know, we all have the niece or nephew who comes out at 30, and we say, "Oh yeah, we knew when you were 4. We had that lock on lockdown. We were just waiting for you to figure it out, right?" So I think part of the challenge for mental health and understanding queer mental health. I'm just going to take a picture of that. Honest, I'm not going to be up here checking my Facebook. I'm just...
well, if an emergency comes through, you can't help that.
There you go. And I'm just going to grab that napkin right there.
That's what I got for it.
Thank you. So there is... So part of the problem with addressing queer mental health is the idea that queerness aligns too closely, in my view, with the whole issue of sex. And as a society, we're neurotic about sex.
Yeah.
And then as a society, we're not just neurotic, we're downright phobic. Yeah. as it relates to anything that strays from the heteronormative.
Yeah.
And I would say that from an intersectional point of view is stronger or weaker in various communities. So in Nova Scotia, for example, Nova Scotia is generally, until just fairly recently, a half minute ago in our history, we have been a religious society. Because this is I don't want to make reference to it too much, but a slightly older crowd, most of us will remember the person in our family who was either Catholic and married a Protestant, or Protestant and married a Catholic, who then never entered a church again. So if you can imagine that our religiosity can create such oppression for people for marrying across denominations, not across faiths. We're not talking about Christians marrying Muslims or Jews. We're talking about Christians marrying another sect of Christian. Up until just a half minute ago in our history, that was a real problem. So how are we going to deal with queer people in a society that can't even deal with Protestants marrying Catholics? So that issue of the neurosis around sex is a big problem. So let me, in my social worky way, give you a quick definition of mental health, because if we're going to talk about mental health, we should know what we're talking about, right? Okay? So mental health is really, forget about the DSM for a minute. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Health kind of defines all of the mental health problems, right? Whether it's depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, whatever. Forget about that for a minute. Mental health is really about the ability to function and cope in our society. The ability to get up in the morning, maintain the relationships necessary for us to contribute and receive those services and exchanges and relational spaces that are a part of being part of the human community, right? That's really what it's about. And if you can function, it doesn't really matter what you got going on. Nobody's going to seek to diagnose you if you can function. We only seek to diagnose people when the functioning starts to decrease. Right? So mental health is really about ability to function.
Yeah.
And there are two things that affect our ability to function in terms of what activates our mental health problems. One is our biological vulnerability. Right? So we know that if a person suffers from depression, one of the questions that will be asked of you is, oh, has anybody in your family suffered from a mental health condition? Because we know that biologically there are some elements of mental health that can be passed down. Right? Were you aware about that?
Nope.
Like alcoholism, for example, right? That's an example. But the biological vulnerability, we'll call this passed down. But it's passed down. And I don't want to get too complicated, but there are two ways to pass down these vulnerabilities. Right? One is purely biological. Right? Purely biological. So you could have had come from a family with a long history of mental health problems, and you could have been adopted away from that family at birth, and genetically you might still carry some of the predispositions to mental health problems. Right? The other way of passing down biological vulnerabilities, though, is social. Right? We call this the intergenerational transmission of things like trauma.
That's what I was going to say.
Right?
Traumatic, something you see a murder, or you watch your family get killed, your home, your family gets burned. And
Or you grow up in a family where there's tremendous tension.
Yeah.
Right? Where, you know, you're developing in that the toxic soup of neurosis and tension and anxiety and pressures that biological vulnerability can be passed down in multiple ways. We often think about intergenerational trauma as an example of that, right? So indigenous people who were subjected to residential schools, and so then the parents who had grown up in residential schools not having an ability to bond and attach and parent, their children then create the same kinds of dysfunctions in their children that they grew up with, and then that is a curse that gets passed down through the generations unless a major intervention can stop it. But it is passing down a vulnerability that gets not written into our genetic code, but in what we call the epigenetics. But it's passed down environmentally. But the other thing that affects our mental health is environmental stress. Okay? Environmental stress. So I might come from a family that suffers from depression, but if I have an idyllic childhood, no major stressors, no major traumas, I go to school, I'm well-loved and accepted, I go through my life, there are no major rejections, no major difficulties, I have adequate food, adequate shelter, and it may be that depression may not visit me. Because even though I might have high biological vulnerability, my environmental stress is so low that it doesn't activate my mental health problem. Right? This is why, for example, cancer survivors they're suggested, like, keep your stress low. Don't overtax yourself, because you could reactivate a cancer, for example.
And also there's people who suffer from PTSD.
Absolutely.
Be very careful.
Yeah.
It can be cured, but it can be controlled.
Yeah. Well, I think that we'll talk a little bit about trauma in greater detail if time allows. And does that just remind me, how much time do we have?
Oh, if you want to, you can go all the way till 3, but
3:30. Really.
Okay.
Lots of time.
So this is the test. If I can hold the audience, I can go on and on. But what the guy said, when you're done listening, I'm done talking. That's the way that works. But anyway, when we think about this intersection of environmental stress and biological vulnerability, there is an imaginary curve. I say it's imaginary because nobody really understands it. Okay? This is just a model for understanding. The curve, I think, and since I'm up here with the marker, is parabolic.
What is parabolic?
It's not a straight line. It's not a circle. It's just a parabola, which means that it's... it's just its shape.
Like a little hill.
Yeah, like a little hill. Which suggests that something like this. If your biological vulnerability to mental illness is here, and your environmental stress is here, then you are on the well side of the line. Right? You see that? Now, what happens if your biological vulnerability increases, or your environmental stress increases? Then you could be on the ill side of the line. Right? So everybody knows that if you can generally function and then you get the flu, depression might accompany this flu. Why? Because your biological vulnerability increased, right? And you're not able to fight off the blues as well. Right? Everybody knows that if you're doing quite well, but something changes at the job, and the demands on you become unreasonable, and the relationships there become fractured and strained, and the people there don't accept you, that your stress goes up and you can pass from wellness into illness. Right? So just take a minute and think about that. Right? Because this is a generic model for understanding mental health and mental illness. Right? I did say that one of the biological vulnerabilities that can be passed down can be trauma. And intergenerational trauma. Okay. Who suffers from intergenerational trauma? Well, people who've been historically oppressed by our society. Okay. So, indigenous people, intergenerational trauma. Black people, intergenerational trauma. Okay. Who else suffers from intergenerational trauma?
Jewish people,
people who've lived in war and conflict. Anybody else?
Poor people.
I'm sorry? Poor?
Poor
people. Yeah. Anybody else?
Japanese Canadians.
Anybody else?
Chinese. People with mental illness.
People with mental illness, yeah?
Two world wars and the depression. That was my mother.
Yeah, there you go. Talking to a group of queer people, nobody said... Queer people.
I was going to say that
right?
Next.
This society historically has oppressed queer people. And even though people tend to develop their queer identity, their queer awareness, when your queer awareness begins to emerge in this society, it emerges alongside a growing understanding of the lack of acceptability of your queer identity. Right? So you drift into this multi-generational awareness of the oppression of your people. And unlike coming from any other community, you're doing it alone. If you're a black child growing up in a black family, When you become aware of your blackness and the oppression that comes with being black, you have a black mother or father or parent or siblings or community to help you to integrate the knowledge of that. And you are gifted with intergenerational strategies for coping. Right? If you're indigenous, when you come to an awareness of how your indigeneity has teed you up in this society for oppression and exclusion and violence, you're growing up within the context of an indigenous community that can help you integrate the reality. But too often, queer people, as their identity begins to develop, their queer identity, they don't have a natural community of queer elders within their family who can help them integrate the knowledge of their oppression with their knowledge of their identity. And so developing queer identity can have an isolating effect. And so queer children particularly can have a very different experience in terms of their environmental stress and their biological vulnerability. And I think, again, thinking about queer mental health, and I might go down a rabbit hole or two here while I'm up front, but I think it creates unspeakable dangers for young queer people. And makes young queer people extremely vulnerable to exploitation and to violence and to spending too much time on this side of the wall of wellness. That's what I call that, the wall of wellness.
And do we have figures? Are there suicide rates higher?
Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, I mean,
I think I read somewhere that
their suicide rates are extremely higher in queer communities, and that has some jurisdictional issues as well, and we can see that happening in different spaces. But all of the health indicators, when we see children who are, like I say, disconnecting from school, having behavioral problems at home, having difficulties with their peers, having difficulties with their family members who are dislocating, right? We don't often identify that may be a reaction to the hostility that children are experiencing within their environment, because very few young children who are developing those behavioral problems can say to their guidance counselor or to their parent, "You know what's got me all fucked up? It's the fact I'm queer and y'all aren't queer friendly." You know? When were you able to come to that realization? Right? Think about that. Right? Very few of us were able to be in that comfortable a space to be able to define what was going on with us until much later in our lives. And yet it's happening. And it's, again, I think one of the reasons why such a disproportionate number of young people who are homeless identify as 2SLGBTQI. The reason I talk about this is because I like for us to think about the things that cause mental health problems. It's not just your biological vulnerability. It's also the environmental stress. And this environmental stress affects different populations differently. I'm black in a racist society. Being black brings environmental stresses that are about systemic racism. It's not about Robert Wright. The therapist who would work with me and say, "Well, let's think differently about your depression. Let's think differently about your anxiety. Let's see some strategy." If that therapist cannot say, "Your anxiety makes sense to me as a black person living in a racist society, boy, that's real. Uh-huh. Yeah. Let's externalize that problem and figure out where that comes from, because it's not coming from inside of you. So when we talk about queer-specific therapies, I always say that a queer-specific therapy must be able to address the social and environmental factors affecting queer people. Because queer mental health is no different in its construction than anybody else's mental health. The two things apply. But what your mental health provider must understand is what are these issues, right? And to a similar extent, but maybe slightly less a problem, they must understand how queerness and the social problem of queerness is a historical legacy that we live with. And in this society, it's everywhere in terms of the legislations, the religious histories, all of that. Is this making sense? Is this at all mildly interesting? Okay. Is this Dan? I'm on track. Okay. So. Again, I'm not checking my Facebook. I'm going back to the... it's January, and so I've changed all of my passwords, which means I can't access anything anywhere on any device at any time. Here we go.
So, Robert, it sort of sounds like you're asking social workers and therapists and mental health care people to change the world, not the patient.
Yes.
Not a small task.
Well, I think that. Do you know what the number one cure for poverty is in our society? What is the number one cure for poverty in our society?
Education.
Anybody else?
Ending. Get rid of the rich people.
I think Ian's onto something here. The number one cure for poverty is giving people money. Right? Now, that sounds simplistic. But you understand that as a society, we have talked a lot about child poverty and the child poverty index. I don't know about you, but every child I know is poor. Like, none of them has an income. Even trust fund children don't get access to their income until later in their life. Why do we talk about child poverty? We talk about child poverty because as a society, we want to try to figure out how to help poor children without taking their parents out of poverty. Right? So we separate them in our minds from their parents. And we talk about solving child poverty because children are worthy poor, and their parents, of course, are just layabouts. So we don't want to take them out of poverty. We just want to take the children out of poverty. When in reality, the number one thing you can do to end child poverty is to ensure that no parents are in poverty. Right? But it's we need to change the world if we want to change poverty. Right? Similarly, we need to change the world if we want to address the mental health concerns, particularly the mental health concerns of oppressed populations, and that includes queer people.
You think quantum AI is a good bet?
What was it?
Quantum AI.
Quantum AI? Yeah. The problem is human beings have never invented anything that has not assisted them in the project of systematic oppression of other peoples. Just think about that. You tell me one thing that people designed and created that did not aid them in the oppression of other people. Anyway, that's just a thought experiment. I'll leave it there. That's I'm going down a rabbit hole. going down a rabbit hole. Yes.
I want to add something for what you just said, right?
Yeah.
So poverty is a standard that has been also created by society that we live now, right? Because I remember being in the Amazon jungle with indigenous community when kids, they were all happy. There was no these standards. Oh, this is a richer. This person have more than the other kid. They all were living equally in the dirt, in the water, whatever. You know what I mean? So it's not possible to change that standard of, oh, this is being poor and this is being rich, and we all need to achieve being rich to be somebody, to be to be better, to be accepted.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yes, yes, yes.
You know my point?
I get you. It's a social standard that is very, very hard to change, but I think that it is possible. So it's possible both on an individual level and on a structural level.
I think, but sorry for interrupting.
No.
If we all have our basic needs covered, food, shelter, education, I don't think you can be considered poor.
No, this is true.
Right?
No.
The rest is, oh, if I have a jacket who is a brand, or you know what I mean?
Yes.
But changing these standards of poverty and right, mm-hmm. will help, and always make sure everybody have access to all these things: education, food, shelter, the basic needs that we all need to feel secure, so we'll feel safe, right?
Well, again, we would have to achieve that by creating a society that decided that that was critical. Like, we live in a society, even though we say our healthcare system is broken, you know, if you're at home and you're having a heart attack and you dial 911, eventually someone comes and they deal with that. We've decided that that is important. But if you find yourself on a park bench and you have no place to stay in out of the weather, even in February, if you dial 911... we don't have a response to that. And we've decided that as a society, that there is no 911 response for that. Anyway, I wanted us to think about this as a construction of mental health, because it'll apply when we think about queer mental health across the lifespan. And so we've got some questions here about typical problems and queer-specific therapy. In terms of the typical problems, yes, I'm the guy at the marker, and I'm the guy whose name is on the agenda today. But I would say that again, thinking about environmental stress. Access to resources, as they say, money won't buy you happiness, but it can certainly tamp down the environmental stress. Right? Yeah. And so I'd say that the kinds of problems that I see in the queer community that are affecting mental health are kind of the systemic issues. Right? Systemic issues. So I would say, thinking about it developmentally from like birth to senescence, which is a
old.
Yeah, there you go. I've been trying to avoid that term, but there you have it. From birth to old age, or very old age, as they say. Right? I would say that developmentally, the first problem is developing queer and questioning identity and isolation and fear. And I would say that before a person who is queer begins to experience in early childhood exclusion and oppression, they begin to experience an internal crisis that is an issue of isolation, fear, and anxiety. Right? Yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but this has really been on my brain. One of the big problems I think our community has, and I think it's with any oppressed community, is taking on the identity of being the victim and using it as a crown of glory or as a crown of pain or both, and for false legitimacy or to become bitter or mm-hmm. to just say, I'm a fuck up, who cares, give me the joint. Did you find that's something I think we can attack and should identify?
I would say that, what would I call it? Hopelessness and nihilism is a queer problem that develops a little later than this. Right? It's an early adolescent problem. If it begins to develop, it tends to take its roots there. Right? But I'm suggesting that the first thing that starts to develop is an internal awareness of queerness that causes problems. And that might be accompanied very, very closely by, you know, the beginning of being identified and targeted for maltreatment. So I'd say that these two things, I guess I would say I've known children who didn't have this awareness until they started to experience this. But I say that they generally, and this is happening in very, very young childhood. I believe this can begin to happen to children as young as 3. These are preschoolers who are beginning to understand that they're different, and that's not good. Right? Now, a developing awareness of difference does not become a mental health problem. It is a developing an awareness of one's difference and a knowledge that that difference is unacceptable that becomes a problem. You see? So it's that environmental stress piece, right? Because when a kid starts playing with the wrong toys and has the toy slapped out of their hands, right? When the kid starts liking the wrong cartoons or is overly fascinated with the wrong gender of the images that they see either in their household or in magazines or on television, and they begin to be sanctioned for that, that this begins to happen. Right? When children begin to identify with the wrong gender or do not identify strongly enough with the right gender, that this begins to happen.
I think that happens at any age.
Yes, it does.
Children. Like, with me, I didn't consider myself gay, queer, or whatever until I was in my 30s.
Yes.
But I did go through.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, it does. But I'm saying that, I guess I would say this is the developmental continuum. I'm linking this to age, but it can also be linked to your own experience, right? It's kind of the next thing that happens, I think, in the queer continuum and the mental health continuum is what I would call the social indoctrination. And now we're talking about formal curricula. Right? So you go to school at the age of 5, preschool maybe at the age of 4, and you're beginning to be socially indoctrinated. And don't kid yourself. I mean, we've all had this experience. very young children know what they need to do to fit in and what can lead to them being excluded or bullied. And so many children during this phase, they either fit in and self-repress, or they can't fit in and they become oddballs. Right? And there are some kids who just can't fit in. They cannot change their disposition. There are other kids who can. Right? I was a churchy young boy. Right? So my lack of interest in sex and sexuality was chalked up to my virtuosity rather than my queer identity. Right? Everybody loves a churchy young boy. Every mother of a daughter loves their daughter's friend to be a churchy young boy. Right? He's the guy who's going to take your daughter to the prom. There's going to be no problems whatsoever. He's such a gentleman. No, he gay. He gay. Like, there's, right? So there's... But these are the options. Now, I mean, I'm making this kind of simplistic because we only have 3 hours and not a full semester. But you get where I'm coming from, right?
Absolutely.
Right? Yes?
Robert, it sounds a little bit like describing left-handers who a century ago got their hand swatted with a ruler when they wrote with the wrong hand, and some of them were able to switch over kind of badly right with their right hand.
Yeah,
that happened in 1960.
And other ones couldn't.
Yeah.
And we decided that was a bad idea 100 years ago?
Not quite 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Right? You know, it was probably not until the 60s that we decided that was okay. Yeah. It was okay to be left-handed. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
So, you know, like I said, can't marry a Catholic. You can't be left-handed.
You can't
boy, being queer, boy, it's way down the line.
You can't be interracial.
Can't be interracial, right?
Yeah.
So. So, and if we understand that these are oppressive ideas in society, it helps us to understand how the environmental stress is impacting the mental health of queer people. Okay? That's where I'm going, so that we understand that queer mental health is not about the craziness associated with queerness. It is about the social and environmental stressors that are creating mental health problems for queer folk. I'm going to skip a few things here. I'm going to go into adolescence, and I'd say that in adolescence, then, children begin to experience more independence, and then they have some very, very challenging decisions to make, whether or not those decisions are conscious or not. Right? Do I go find myself? Or conform? And sublimate? Right? Sublimating is just, you know, kind of repressing and repressing and repressing that what is natural to oneself until it just disappears.
Stay in the closet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that this is why we see so many young people, queer young people, homeless, because when they go to find themselves, they have to go elsewhere to do that. Right? You know? So you think about this. Your burgeoning queer identity, all of the challenges that you've already had with your internal struggle, with the bullying and the demarcation of yourself as an oddball, with your now getting into middle school and all of that kind of thing, and you're in, I don't know, Kingston, Nova Scotia, or Digby, or Guysborough County.
Guthrie.
What? Guthrie. Yeah. And Why are these kids on the street of Halifax? Because they can find family and community here. As dysfunctional and as problematic as that is, it's a better choice than dying at home. Right? For a lot of kids. So that's the find yourself route. Yes?
During my early adolescence, I found myself.
Yeah.
And I was very out.
I'll repeat what she says.
Yeah.
Just yeah.
I was very out, but as sort of it's conforming and sublimating, it's like no, not conforming, but sublimating. You might use the word sublimating because like it wasn't a sexual thing.
Yeah. So yeah, you found yourself and were very, very out.
Yep.
But you weren't sexually active.
No desire to be.
Yes. Again. We know this, the continuum. Asexuality is a real thing, you know. I'm not saying you were asexual.
Just for a period.
Yes. So again, just not engaging sexually, and maybe it's one of the challenges of being queer and young is that. I always say this. Because we have to recognize that a part of this is about sex. I'm not saying that queerness is all about sex. I'm saying that part of the discussion is about sex, and in particular, our social neurosis around sex. Because I have always said that all human beings in this society, anyway, stumble towards healthy sexuality. Okay? We all stumble towards healthy sexuality. What do I mean by that? I mean that in grade 5, the boys played over here and the girls played over here, and one of the games we did was that the group of guys would push a guy into the girls, and he would fumble into the girls and cop a fee along the way down. That was young people fumbling into some kind of sexuality.
Yeah.
Right? Was that appropriate? Hell no. But when I spoke about it, we got a lot of laughs because everybody remembered.
We did.
Hey, we did that. That was our fumbling way into sexuality. Right? And then the notes get passed. Do you like me? Yes or no? Then the whispers start. Jill says she'd like to be your girlfriend. Will you be her girlfriend? Yes or no? But Bob does not get a chance to pass a note to Charlie to say, will you be my boyfriend, yes or no? Right? So all of the unhealthy fumbling towards sexuality is acceptable in the heteronormative paradigm, but the fumbling towards healthy sexuality is completely forbidden outside of that heteronormativity. Right? Yes, I'm sorry.
Could you say more about what exactly you mean by a social neurosis about sexuality?
I'd say that as a society, we do not have a socially healthy approach to sex. There is no real... For example, sex education is still a controversial thing in our society. Even though we know that every single person who comes out of the womb will have a sexuality somewhere on the continuum, including asexual. And yet, sexual education is a controversial thing in our society. Right? I'd say that heteronormativity is the norm, the accepted norm in our society, and any talk outside of that is divergent, even though human sexual practice has not ever lined up with the heteronormative ideal that is spoken of.
Since the beginning of time.
Okay. So we're neurotic about it. We're not truthful about it. We're not open about the reality. And we're still in an environment where people who are divorced experience stigma in our society. I think that one of the things that the Pope has recently done in the Catholic Church is said, well, you know, we can bless unions that are irregular, which includes people who are divorced and remarried. So we are living in a society in which there is a legitimate international religious organization that still does not acknowledge divorce as real. Okay? How more neurotic can we be? 50% of marriages end in divorce.
Is it 50%?
And that number has stayed the same for at least a generation. But what people who quote the stat don't tell you is dramatically fewer and fewer people in our society are getting married.
I'm in bad shape. I was brought up Catholic. I'm divorced, and I've realized I'm bisexual and could even be fully lesbian if anything ever happened to my boyfriend, Gerard.
There you go.
Yeah. So I'm in a
So you're a lesbian with a named exception.
Yeah.
Gerard is the named exception. But
I am bisexual.
No, there you go. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But, you know, what I'm saying is that's what I'm talking about, the neurosis in our society about sex.
Yeah.
When I worked in education in the early 90s, it was against the regulations for a school board staff person to give a condom to a child.
Real?
And I worked in Highland Park Junior High School, an inner city junior high school, a very mixed race group of kids, a very earthy group of kids. These are kids who knew the street very well. And things used to go through the junior high school like a rash. Like some people, you just remember when purple Fila's or Fila shoes were a thing, and everybody had to have a pair of Fila's. And so the kids from my school used to go down to the rink and just steal the shoes off of kids that had Fila's. That was the school I worked in. And so everybody had feelings. Everybody was happy. Those kids, their parents could buy them another pair, and the kids who couldn't afford to get them got them in through innovation. But it went through the school like a rash. And sex went through the school like a rash. Right? Poor people and black people are dramatically overrepresented among those people who contract HIV, for example. And I'm working in a poor and black community. And it comes to my attention that the kids are having sex like bunnies. Right? Because having sex is the thing. And it got to the point where people were just hooking up and arranging hookups for their buddies. Hey, you know, Sally, Joe hasn't had sex yet, and we know you give it up. Will you have sex with Joe so Joe can have had sex? Yeah, so Sally negotiates that, and the sex is gone. And I just said, whew, okay, condoms like candy. Okay, this is what, and I went to my principal, and I said, I might get fired, but I'm going to be passing out condoms to everybody. And I'm going to be having conversations, deep conversations with people about sex and sexuality. And I'm going to be doing that in the same way that is necessary in this community. So I would bring kids into my office, and I'd pass them a condom. And they say, oh, yeah, thanks, Mr. Wright. They go to put it in their pocket. And I said, no, I got plenty of those. This one is for us today. I said, I need you to open it up. So I'd open up the package. I'd say, now I want you to play with the condom. I want you to roll it down your hand. I want you to rub it on your face. I want you to put it on your tongue. And sometimes the kids would go, Mr. Wright, oh, Mr. Wright, no, I can't. Mr. Wright, I can't do that. Can't do that, Mr. Wright. I said, let me be clear with you. Sex is pretty messy. Pretty messy. And this condom just came out of a sterile wrapper. There's nothing in this condom that's going to help hurt you. And if you can't play with it, touch it, feel it, taste it, you're not ready for sex. Now, here's a handful of condoms. Go with God. And I remember I did that. And several years later, many years later, a college kid came to me and was talking to me. He had been a kid of mine in junior high school. and we were talking, we were chatting and so forth, and then he said, oh yeah, and Mr. Wright? I said, what's that? He says, me? Every time. Every time. So he's saying to me, he has used a condom every single time he has had sex. Because of the conversation that we had in junior high school.
Right? Just a quick question.
Yes.
The principal, the administration there, permitted you to do this work, did they? You didn't run into any issues?
The administration agreed with me that they were completely unaware of any of my activities.
Oh, my God. I love that.
So I informed about everything, him about everything, and yet we were both, you know, plausible deniability. Yeah. We knew that if we were ever called, I would take the hit for it, and he knew nothing. That was our agreement. So, anyway. So this thing happens in adolescence. You find yourself or you conform and sublimate. And the different kinds of sublimation are, like I said, I became a churchy kid. This is sometimes where the nihilism sets in, right? Because the one group of kids in any school that you can become a member of with it's a club that has a very, very low bar for acceptance, right, is the nihilistic stoners. Mm. Right? All you need to be a member of that club is to understand the rules of the rotation. Right? What are the rules of the rotation? Puff, puff, pass. Right? That's the only thing you need to know to be a member of the club.
Sorry, I didn't really understand.
Yeah. Puff, puff.
Oh,
pass.
Oh, okay.
Puff, puff.
Okay. If you're looking at it as a smoker, so
right?
Hot smoker.
Puff, puff. Oh. Pass. And then you don't have to worry about anything. What you wear, who you have sex with, what you watch on TV. No one cares. Nothing matters. Right? Right? So this can have some very difficult consequences. And then, of course, for the folk who come out later in life, and I'm just going to say later adulthood, all of this can happen. At any stage, right? After your first marriage, after your second marriage, after your first failed career, after whatever, all of this can begin to develop in adulthood, and that's to your point, right? That it can happen in your 30s, right? Something happens that you. Oh, thank you.
I thought it was fine.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Something can happen that triggers you. Right? Into the necessity for coming to terms. Now, I'm not going to suggest that queerness is like addiction. I'm not going to suggest that, but I'm going to use a language of addiction, right? Because often folk who have, I'll call it, been resisting the call, have to hit a bottom of sorts. How unhappy do you need to be in your life before you will come to terms with the reality and the truth of your life? Right. And that bottom might look like any number of things. Right. For me, and I'll just share personally, like I said, I was in a marriage for 12 years that had a shelf life of 3. So for 8 years, I was in a marriage that was getting less and less functional and more dangerous for myself and my daughter. My ex had some mental health problems and it became extremely problematic. And so for me, to separate and divorce and then go through 2 years of shared parenting hell and then to become a single parent, not a shared parent, but a single parent, and to come out meant that I had to disrupt my church affiliation, which had been a lifeblood for me since the time I could read. Mm. Right? And I had served my church in the local, regional, national, and international levels, sitting on international commissions and committees, and was an able and very sought-after lay preacher, and I did all the things. I married people, I buried people, I administered what are the Protestant sacraments, if we can call them that, for the sake of ease, and it dried up like that. But for me, gratefully and thankfully, I didn't lose a day to work throughout that entire period. But I had hit a wall and had to come to terms. And I had to accept the radical shift and change in my life. Right? And I didn't succumb to... and I think that, well, I did have a mental health crisis... I had moved my family. We'd gone to Ontario, where I was going to pursue some postgraduate studies. I say postgraduate studies, not a PhD, because I didn't finish a PhD. But I have significant postgraduate studies, so that's what I'll call it. I successfully did some postgraduate work, rather than I failed at getting a PhD. Very different language. So my family was in Ontario. Things weren't going well, I'll just say that. And I started to lose the capacity to do the things that a graduate student does. You know, read, think, write, that sort of thing. Like, I couldn't read. I lost the focus, the mental focus, the ability to read. And I went to my doctor, and I said, I have a tumor or something. I'm dying. I need all the scans. I need all the tests. She said, okay, well, let's talk about your life for a little bit. She talked about my life. Robert, that sounds really like depression. I said, no, I'm Robert Wright. No, it's not depression. I'm dying. Well, really, in my world...
What?
What's that?
I'm laughing with you now.
Yes, that's right. Well, you feel free to laugh at me, because right now I'm laughing at old me. Right? It was easier for me to comprehend the possibility of me dying from a brain tumor than the idea that I could be depressed by my life circumstances. Mm-hmm. Right?
Being all that training, you just couldn't accept that you had an illness yourself.
Exactly.
So
exactly. Right? So she sent me for all the tests. And I saw the doctor about a week and a half later, and she was smiling a little bit, smirking really at me. And she said, I've got good news and bad news, Robert. The good news is all your tests came back negative. The bad news is all your tests came back negative. So I had to accept the reality that I was in depression. Mm-hmm. Right? I'm a mental health professional. Right? What was it? A renowned mental health professional. Thank you, Zach. I'll put that on my bio next time. So she said, okay, I'm going to prescribe you this thing. So she prescribed me medication, and I was planning to take my family back to Nova Scotia to set them up, and I was going to come back and try to salvage what I could. But she says, well, I'm only giving you a 10-day supply, so we made an appointment for like 14 days hence. So she says, well, you can't start and stop this medication, so don't start taking it until 10 days before our appointment. Okay? So the first day I was supposed to take the medication, I was on the road to Nova Scotia, coming from Ontario. Took the meds. The second day I woke up, I'm standing in the bathroom with the pill in my hand. Now, I'm a renowned, I'm told, mental health professional. Right? And I said, okay, let's think about environmental stress and biological vulnerability. What has passed me over into the wall of... past the wall of wellness into illness? My environmental circumstances. I control to some degree, my environmental circumstances. So for me, personally, and I'm not against medication, I'm saying for me personally, in that moment, that pill was a substitute for making difficult decisions. Mm-hmm. You hear me? So I had to decide, do I continue to conform or do I find myself? Well, I flushed that piece, put the rest in my toiletry bag, and I said, okay, it's time. And that began my journey. To accepting my queer identity, to dealing with all of that work necessary that I could live within a space of wellness. Now, the good news is I already had a master's degree. I had coped well enough that I was a bona fide professional, a recognized professional. It didn't affect me. Not everybody will be that privileged. So I've talked a lot, and now we're getting to later adulthood, right? And about mental health in later adulthood. And let me just say this, that the issues are the same. Environmental stress, biological vulnerability. Whether that biological vulnerability is biological inheritance from our parents and their mental health concerns, or an intergenerational trauma as a function of our race or ethnicity or other marginalized identity, including our queerness, that has developed in us some vulnerabilities from the earliest part of our identity, and the environmental stress. So again, treating the mental health of older queer folks is about addressing the environmental stress issues that still exist. Queer community has made lots of gains. There's rainbow flags everywhere, you know, that sort of thing. But it seems like the world is going in two directions, right? At the same time that there are lots of gains as far as the freedoms and the acceptance of queer identity, right? There is a very vocal and regressive discourse that's happening in society. And I would say this, I would not blame it on Donald Trump. Okay. Nor would I blame it on Pierre Poilievre. Mm-hmm. Right? Okay. Remember, we had Harper before they had Trump, so we're really in Canada. Not to get overly political. Suffice to say that there have been loud, regressive, and homophobic and transphobic voices in Canada since before there was a Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. That's all I'm saying. So we have both this growing freedom, yet the tongues of the regressive, homophobic, and transphobic folk have been loosed, and there are spaces in which those messages are allowed to be spoken very loudly. Right?
Well, look at the laws in New Brunswick.
And not being able to teach children about homosexuality.
Yes.
We want to stop that now.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that for me, it goes back to the thing that we talked about in terms of training and the need for training, right? And we have to recognize that the training necessary for educators and healthcare providers has to go deeper than understanding biological sex.
Yeah.
Right? It really has to go into understanding the social history of the oppression of sexuality. All sexualities. Right?
Right?
And that the queer history and the oppression of queer peoples is a part of that history that has been erased. Right? So feminism has done a really good job at detailing the history of the oppression of women. Mm-hmm. And articulating the enemy as patriarchy. but it hasn't. Feminism really hasn't articulated that same patriarchy as oppressive of people in the queer continuum, including men who identify in the queer continuum. So we need to kind of infuse that history as part of the education, not just for healthcare providers, but for educators and anyone in the health and human services who works in these with people and in all human resource spaces, because queer people got to work, and psychological safety in the workplace is the number one challenge in workplace health and safety today. The number one challenge.
We need a place to live. We need medical care.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, those are things that that need to happen. And so, in terms of the mental health of elders, of course, this translates into the education of long-term care providers and home care providers. And, of course, all medical providers, because as we age, we need more medical service delivery, right? So so that is something that is necessary, right? And it isn't just, because when I do this training, people who are on the receiving end of the training always ask, what are the three things I can do to better serve my queer clients? I said, first of all, you can stop asking for a simple answer. That's the first thing you've got to do, right? Because it's not like, you know, hooking up an IV is the same for a queer person as it is for a straight person, right? Clipping the toenails is the same for a queer person as it is for a straight person. It's really the human engagement piece that has been informed by the service provider's indoctrination into the isms and obias, the racism, the homophobia, the transphobia, and the like. And that's the piece that needs to be unpacked. Right? And that work of training, there are two parts to it. Right? There is the what I would call the I didn't take a picture of that. I'm sorry. I'm getting ahead of myself. There are two parts to the training. And when I list them, you might agree or disagree. That didn't work. So there are two parts to the training. And this is a... And I fear that my presentation might be a little... I might disappoint you.
Never.
I sincerely do.
Yes.
Would that be so terrible? As like so much so far.
This is the training has to be transformational and informational, if informational is a word. By that I mean, anyone who seeks to improve their capacity to work with people across a diversity, including the queer diversity, must have information about the people that they serve. That, frankly speaking, is the easy part. There must be, they must also experience a transformation. And that's not about knowledge about others, that's about knowledge of oneself. So, all of us, as we continue to work in an increasingly diverse society, have to acknowledge that we have been trained and socialized in a Eurocentric, heteronormative culture such that we all carry those phobias and isms inside of ourselves. And our job, if we are going to be competent caregivers, must be not only to gain greater information about others, but to deepen our knowledge about ourselves such that we are able to understand our own biases, prejudices, and the ways in which we have harmed other people, so that we can begin to engage in less harmful practice. But it starts with self-awareness and an acknowledgement that I have harmed other people. As a therapist, we have to come to terms with the fact that, oh, yeah, you know, early on as a therapist, I probably harmed as many people as I helped. That's not easy to say out loud. Right? And I'm sure that I have had lots of people come to me with what I would call a presenting issue. Right? And I was never able to get at what the underlying issue was because I was not able to create the confidence and the safety necessary for them to talk about it. It's not when I train therapists, and I do that, I've been training therapists since 1996 or 1997. One of the things that I say to folk is that, you know, it is our job to create the conditions for the client to be able to begin to address the real issues. Right? And that really requires us to be aware of how we create barriers to that. So, I have to be aware, for example, as a black man, that a queer person who enters a therapy space with me would have natural reasons to question whether or not I can be accepting of them as a queer person. Why? Because of the historical and more virulent forms of homophobia that exist in the black community. Why? Because of the black church being such a large foundational part of the black community. And so in order for me to overcome those signals that my client is receiving, I have to broadcast my openness at a higher frequency. You see what I'm saying? So I have to go over the top to let them know. I know that there are things about my presentation, and you know, I often say, and I'm one of those people who people will say, "Oh, you don't really look queer," and I, you know, that kind of thing. They always mean that as a compliment. It's kind of, you know the response that you have to give to that. Right, I always say, well, you know, it's amazing how queer I look with a dick in my mouth. That's the response.
I love it.
And it kind of, people think that that's vulgar and say, well, you just think about what you just said to me, and then judge my response accordingly. Yeah. Judge my response. Exactly. But it's, so I need to broadcast at a higher frequency. And sometimes that requires self-disclosure, which therapists are trained not to do. Right?
Really?
Yeah. So again, all of these Eurocentric constructs of therapy have to be broken if we are going to provide adequate therapy and help for people who, whose needs are outside of that context. Yes?
You're saying that the therapist, that you feel that may be necessary to self-disclose your own experiments?
Self-disclose your own experience, self-disclose your own disposition about an issue, right? Because a therapist is not a therapy machine that is objective and separated from the world. The therapist is a part of the world. And for queer folk, the world has been unkind. And so the therapist must project past the wall of therapeutic objectivity and connect the therapist to the humanity that the therapist has that opens them up to be accepting of their experience.
It seems to me that there's not nearly enough of that.
No, because, and this is part of the problem, and let me shift because I only have a few more minutes and say this. What is the state of things? Let's remember now that Pride Health in Nova Scotia is how old? Would it be 10 years old? 10, 15 years old?
Yeah.
So the reality is, and this is just the beginning. I mean, Gary Dart, who's been involved in Pride Health, he just is working on his master's degree, just now working on his master's degree. Right? So that means that the vast majority of healthcare professionals and mental health professionals were schooled in a time and educated at a time before Pride Health. Right? So even those of us who are black or queer or indigenous or otherwise, we have to overcome our training in order to be the kind of therapist that could engage across those barriers. Right?
Well, in the past, I've found some that... I mean, I have a long past. I'm in my 70s, so it's like... it may not have been a good training, but that's... I can think of one moment in particular where it's like, that was great. You know, they made...
Yeah.
Deepen the relationship so much.
Yeah. I've had a therapist since 1997, with a 4-year gap when my therapist retired, and it took me 4 years to find a therapist. But in that interim, I had a therapist who was a gay man for a brief period of time. We might have had 3 sessions. He never once mentioned the fact he was a gay man.
Hmm.
Right? That's how... Now, he was an older man than me. His training was so powerful that it repressed the identity that he could express in therapy. Right? So we're still in the beginning stages of training therapists who can actually effectively, with the knowledge that they've learned from their training, engage with queer folk, black folk, indigenous folk, immigrant folk, you know, you name it. All of the isms and obias. So we're just in the nascent stage of that. And, you know, I'll just name that the investigators are relatively young people. Right? So this is the generation of practitioners who are emerging who will have that capacity. And so in another half generation, they will be out there practicing as seasoned practitioners. And I'll be long gone. Well, no. Social workers never retire. They just reduce their caseloads. So that's the state of things.
That's
right?
Very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. In my view. Now, this is one guy's view. And I have found over the years that because of my unique location as a queer black man, who's done a significant amount of work with sexual violence, and I run a treatment group for male-identified victims of sexual violence, I've had a lot of queer and questioning folk, a lot of mid-career folks coming to me with the presenting problem of, you know, their middle-age crisis, which has a sex, gender, orientation flavor, and they're needing a place to kind of unpack that. And really, I talked about my process of coming to terms with me and becoming openly gay, not the process of wrestling with demons. I had to wrestle with angels.
With what?
I had to wrestle with angels.
With angels.
Because all of the things that I had to deconstruct were the virtuous things. For me, to be gay meant leaving a marriage. Leaving a woman who was evidencing that she was ill in order to protect my daughter and myself from the influence of that. Right? Leaving a church that had been my home since I was a very young child, and leaving all opportunities for faith service and leadership. Right? So it was the process of wrestling with angels and no longer conforming with the heteronormative expectations. And fortunately for me, that crisis did not drive me to drink or use drugs or well, you know, buy a Corvette or whatever else men in middle age do to
deal with these things.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess I'm saying all that. Now, there are lots of things I probably didn't get to, but I'm going to check the list.
And save some time for a social time, Robert, please.
Yes. Well, I'll hang around.
With you, yeah.
Yeah. So, yes, and I guess the queer mental health for elders, the question of isolation again, we've talked about how that internal identity stuff can create the isolation, but it can also be created by the fact that people don't know what to do with you. People don't know what to do with you. And on the queer continuum, I think gay men have made a lot of gains, and there are spaces for them in society. I think lesbians, oddly enough, there had been, in my view, less fear of lesbians, but less acceptance of lesbians at the same time. I don't know, that's just my take of it. And then, of course, when we enter into queer and non-binary folk, these are the bodies that are the least acceptable in our society. And so the greatest challenge exists in that community for us to find ways to meet and serve their needs. The needs of that member of the family. When I talk about queer, trans, non-binary people and bodied people, we need to appreciate that the conservative statistics right now say that about 1 in 3 female-identified person will experience sexual violence across their lifespan. About 1 in 4 male-identified person will experience sexual violence across their lifespan. And for trans and non-binary individuals, the stat is almost ubiquitous, that almost all trans and non-binary bodied individuals will experience sexual violence across their lives.
This is shocking.
It gives us some indication of how vulnerable bodies are preyed upon. I remember, I'll say this and then I'll say one last thing and then we'll spend some time. A dear friend of mine who was a drag queen kind of, I say drag queen kind of, you know, individual, Santa. Is the person trans? Is the person non-binary? Is the person a drag queen? The lines there are a little fuzzy at times for people. But he called me one time. We were just chatting in the evening, and it was late at night. Like, he'd come home from the bar. I don't go to the bar, but it was during a period of my life when I was sleeping in shifts. You know, you go to bed with your kids. and then you wake up at 1 in the morning and you stay up for 2 hours before you go back to bed, that kind of thing. So we're chatting on the phone, and he says, I'm just running a bath. I got to soak in the bath. So what? He says, oh, yeah. He says, I got roughed up a little bit tonight. What? You got roughed up? He said, yeah, Robert. It's outside the bar, and I was in the face, and I was good. He said, what, are you okay? Do you need me to come over? I said, no, Robert, I just need to run a bath. He said, just another night in the life of a drag queen. And so his experience was, yeah, that's a normal Saturday night for me, to be beaten up. And
he's a 17
to be, right? That's how vulnerable bodies are in the community. And I would wish I could say that that's radically different now than it was 10 years ago. But unfortunately, there is the sexual neurosis of our society runs deep. And if it continues to express itself loudly in the public discourse, you can be sure that it expresses itself violently in dark corners still.
I think drag queens are wonderful. They're an art form.
Absolutely.
They're a ray of sunshine, and they are extremely talented and wonderful seamstresses.
Yes, many. The ones who aren't very successful.
in a store or something.
Absolutely. So
there was a story about that just recently.
Yeah. So I'll say this, that the prospects are good. The investigators, there are other individuals. The People's Counseling Clinic, I've been training therapists since 1996, and the reason I've been training therapists since 1996 is to try to do my own part in transforming this. Okay? And doing my own part in opening up therapists in the course of their training to aspects of the work that they otherwise would not achieve. And when it comes to the work that we are doing, that you are doing as elderberries, in order to kind of transform the service delivery to queer elders, we must advocate for the kind of training that's not just informational, but transformational. Right? And we need to be able to channel our own experience in doing so. Because I think one of the most powerful things that will trigger the transformation is relationships.
Yeah.
It's relationships. Which shouldn't mean that the people who are the care service receivers must take the role of educating their care providers, but we must advocate for their education. Yeah. Last question, and then we'll shut it up.
I was going to say, to go back to what you were saying earlier about therapists kind of being more focused on the deficit or more focused on like what's wrong with you, the new question is more like what happened to you, because you're talking about like socialization throughout the lifestyle.
Lifespan.
So like not being able to feel the right choice, go up the choice we wanted and all that. So it's like what happened to you is more like what I think they're starting to dig into, which I think is a lot more helpful because it's not your fault, it's just kind of how society conditioned you. But I do definitely commend what the investigators are doing. And I'm actually part of the Afrocentric social work cohort. So it's really a new program to really help, really focus more on the individual, so all the cultural, all the systems of oppression really affecting the individual, independent of their culture. So it's not really just it's just like African roots, but it's really for everyone. So I am excited to see what the future holds with all these, you know, these new social workers or people working in the community to help and be more accepting. But I definitely, because I'm new to Nova Scotia, from Ontario, I see the difference here, and I'm just like, oh, it's a lot more taboo to be queer, especially for a person of color with the influence of the church. So all these elements that you're bringing up are very relevant, and I definitely look forward to learning more.
Yes.
Because if I want to do change, I need to know, you know, it's had the idea to see how things are before.
Yes, very good.
So thank you so much for being here today.
And I just have one quick,
yes, go ahead quickly.
Some of my transformation is what is making me bi? Like, my brain's just not wrapping around that. What makes me attracted to women, mm-hmm. but still be able to be with Gerard?
Yeah.
Like what's...
Well, I think that...
I can't seem to fight with it, right?
What I would say is that question, the answer to that question, is kind of simple, right? Yeah. What makes you short? What makes you blonde? What makes you heavyset or thin? What makes your feet big or small?
Are you talking more genetics?
I'm saying is that we come out of the womb and we grow into who we're going to be. And that our queerness and our transness, we need to get to the point where we see that as part of the human experience. Like left-handedness. What makes you left-handed? I don't think we ask that question anymore. We realize there are left-handed people in society. Even if they are less than 50% of our society, they are normal in our society, and we just need to stop trying to beat it out of them. And I think that that's true with the whole of the queer continuum. It's part of the human experience. And when we ask questions of like that, it's almost like, well, what's wrong with me that I'm gay? Instead of saying, I guess I'm gay. Right? And I had, as a queer Christian kid growing up, I had to have that conversation with God. Right? You know? If there's a God, and I'm a churchy guy, I grew up that way, and it's okay, so God, okay. It's kind of like the, who wrote that novel, The Jest of God? Okay, so this is pretty quick, pretty funny, God. You may be a queer, churchy little kid in this particular church, and it's not affirming, and hey, here I am, gay as a blade. All right, let's see what this adventure is going to do to us. But I didn't ask the question, like, why or what's wrong with me? Right? It's my experience. And the problems with me being gay are what? The environmental stresses. Right? That's all it is.
The non-acceptance.
The neurosis in our society is the only thing that's causing me problems in my queerness.
But the why and what's wrong with me are not the same thing. You know? And
true.
It's like from a scientific perspective, it's like, I found it very interesting that, you know, and I saw very little, I didn't go delving into it a lot, but I found it interesting when, you know, research with identical twins, you know, was showing that it was genetic as far as being strictly heterosexual or homosexual, you know, was concerned. And it's like, these days it's like, I'm wondering about people too, and it's like I don't think that's not to wonder what's wrong.
So we could ask that question. I think that would have to be phase two of the workshop, though. So, but let's shut this down. And I want to thank you for your rapt attention. And I do want to have a slice of pizza if any is left. You saved them, Lauren. And we'll close it down very quickly.
You made a very important point just now. And this is what I think we have to work towards, and I'm hoping we're going to see it very soon. The acceptance and normality, accepting people from the LGBTQ community as normal. So we're all part of one large humanity, not the other different.
Yes.
But we have to reach a point where therapists, individuals working in whatever capacity, accept people from the LGBTQ community as normal, not different, not have to be treated differently.
Yeah.
And that's what I would like to see us work towards in the next several years to a decade where we have a society here. Let's be, it would be lovely if Nova Scotia could become a leader in this country in terms of acceptance.
Yeah.
There we go. That would be fantastic. And final comments there, Zach?
Yeah, I just want to thank Robert Wright for coming.
The great